I reckon we make it like spy music.
Weekly Weights with the boys and your mates. Welcome to Weekly Weights. My name is Alex Hayes and with me is Will Berkman, as he will be weekly. We are powerlifting coaches out of Lift Performance Centre in Sydney.
Every week we're going to put out a podcast discussing training concepts, interviewing some lifters that we know, and doing case studies of our own clients where we just see how we apply the principles of training across a cycle to make lifters better.
Stay tuned for more. Weekly Weights.
Today we're going to be talking about what are common errors in execution of the three lifts at powerlifting meets. And just so that we're clear from the outset here, when we say execution, we're talking about deviations from your baseline technique. So whether or not you're generally a pretty technically sound or technically shitty lifter, it's the changes that you make in the meets that we think can be the differences between you making lifts you normally would and missing them. So I guess the brain farts that, you know, we've all seen or experienced at each comp. And Alex and I in the past 2 or 3 weeks have spent maybe 6 days at powerlifting comps, whether we were spotting, coaching, or just watching. So these are things we've been seeing time and time again. We'll do them in order of the lifts. So the first cab off the rank is squat. Alex, what are some errors you've seen in squats?
I think the biggest one would be tempo.
Like tempo of the descent?
Yeah, descent tempo, absolutely. Lifters will miss because they'll sort of slow themselves down into the hole when ideally they should be speeding themselves up into the hole.
Yeah.
And they'll either miss because they don't have enough momentum and don't get enough out of the stretch reflex, or they will actually cut the squat short and miss on depth.
Yeah, so the top lifter, I think a couple of weeks ago, I was saying to you earlier, maybe a third of the girls, like I was back spotting them, a third of them would have missed their third squat.
Yeah.
And at least half of them were on depth because they were cutting it high. Yeah, because the descent speed wasn't high enough. You said they should be speeding up into the hole.
Yep.
So what's like a more ideal squat tempo?
I like to cue 40 to 90, which is percent of speed.
Yeah.
So start the squat at 40%.
Yeah.
And finish at 90. So we never finish at 100 and bottom out.
Yeah.
But we don't want to finish at 60 or 70 because we just won't get enough out of the hole.
Yeah, right. Because when you say like bottoming out into the bottom of your squat, that leads me almost to the second issue that I saw a lot in a meet, was the people who weren't cutting their squats high, many of them actually lose tightness and really drop too hard into the hole. And you often see like upper back start to collapse as they do that, or hips shoot back.
Yep.
And they just lose all sorts of position. And that is often sort of, it's the reverse case. It's like if you feel the weight's really heavy and you feel like you have to control it over much, then you slow down your descent too much. Yep. But then if you feel like you feel the weight's heavy and you can't control it, you drop too fast.
Yep.
And that's an issue I've seen as well.
So what do you think we can do to fix that? Fix the tempo speed.
Fix the tempo. So in training, cueing people 40-90 and just having like a constant rhythm over and over again is good.
Yep.
I've actually found that building up my strength in the descent has actually helped me as well. So for me, doing things like pin squats and pause squats helped because I was having to control into the hole and I got much more comfortable at sort of holding position and then dropping. That's probably my main one, is cue tempo and then do specific variations that strengthen me in those positions.
Yeah. So a couple of cues that I like to use are hit it hard, that's one, or drop it in.
Just put that one on occupied, boys.
Oh yeah, sorry, man. Rawdon, you want to come in, mate? We're talking about powerlifting, but like, if you want to just...
Say hello.
Yeah, come on, mate. Rawdon.
Mate, 285, raw, no belt.
He's stronger than both of us. Stronger than both of us.
Calling Rawdon dubious because his numbers are all made up.
The dubious method.
Alright, so...
The two cues I like to use...
Using cues, yeah, sorry.
The two cues I like to use are hit it hard and drop it in. Drop it in is a Wilkesism.
Yeah, and then obviously chest out of the hole is very important.
Chest forever.
All right. So yeah, that's cueing. And then do you do anything specifically programming wise for people with descent issues or not?
I think closer to the comp, I like to use 2 competition squat days. So if they squat on 2 days, one will be the heavier day, one will be the lighter day. And the practice on the lighter day is just really find that rhythm, find your feet.
Right. So the light day is almost more about rhythm than like overload. It's just get them doing it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. It's trying to try to reinforce the technique that they're supposed to be doing on the heavy day, whether they are or not.
Mm-hmm.
The light day will help them sort of, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know, like consolidate that technique.
That's the one.
Yeah, sure.
Well said.
Yeah, I'm the more well-spoken and also coincidentally better looking of the two hosts. The second technical error we spoke about in the squat was, or the second one that we've both observed, are errors in the setup itself. So, and we see them in two major places. One is at the unwrap and one is with people's gaze. So I'll just cover unwrap quickly and then hand to you for gaze. Oftentimes lifters, when the weight's really heavy, are either inclined to spend way too long trying to get themselves under the bar or way too little time and rush it. And then that's usually compounded down the track. So I find people who unrack the bar poorly tend to lose upper back tightness or lose balance in the squat itself. So sort of, you know, throwing out your technique by rushing it out of the rack is a real issue there. And then people who spend too long, I'm not sure that it actually carries over with any like physical consequences, but they tend to be the ones that just psych themselves out,
basically. It might be a waste of energy.
Yeah, maybe it's a waste of energy, but I just tend to think if you spend too long overthinking it on the platform, then you're more inclined to just those psychological errors and just, yeah.
Yeah, I think on that note, I think unrack and walk out, very important, but I think a lot of people actually set their rack height too high.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
They've unracked the bar, and when it gets heavy, they actually can't stand fully upright, so they don't have that little pop, little gap out of the rack.
Yeah.
So I think most people would probably be better off actually lowering their rack height one and getting a little bit of pop and feeling the weight and letting it settle before walking it out.
Yeah.
If you sort of unrack it and it's heavy, you can't really stand up fully and you're sort of like stumbling back on your walkout. That's going to affect how you, you think about the squat mentally, because it's going to feel heavier.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like when the rack is a tiny bit lower as well, you can almost like pull yourself under it and really wedge your shoulders into it. Whereas when it's high, it's like you're reaching to the rack.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
For sure. So is there anything specifically that you address with people in their training for unracking the squat correctly, or is it just something you do time and time again correctly?
Getting the correct amount of distance out of the rack and setting the feet in the right position, setting them forward enough. A lot of people will rack the bar with their feet behind the bar and they'll end up like sort of extending it and the bar will fall backwards out of the rack. So it's sort of like a back extension rather than like the end of a squat. So if the feet are far enough forward and close together, you can get that sort of clearance out of the rack.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And I think that's it.
Yeah. To be honest, I just basically tell people to like stand up, like start with their feet much narrower than they squat,
mm-hmm.
stand up, mm-hmm. walk out and then set their feet. Whereas most people are inclined to, like if you don't tell them, is to unrack the bar with your feet too wide.
Yeah.
And the second you unrack's off, your squat's off.
Too wide and too far backwards, yeah.
Yeah.
And the walkout as well. I like to cue 3 steps on the walkout.
Yeah.
So the first one's a small step, and then the second one's slightly bigger, and the third one meets the second one. I feel like some people who take 2 steps will sort of swing the bar, and they'll hit the rack on the walkout. And that's another thing that can cause you to sort of make the weight feel heavier than it is.
Yeah. Okay, so far we've basically said that people unrack the bar poorly, descent speed is the most common error, and then the third one that you raised was gaze.
Mm-hmm.
So what changes on heavy squats?
Again, the same as the tempo speed, people get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
So they look all over the place, or they don't have somewhere to look, or they don't know where they're looking. And given you don't generally compete where you train, you don't know where to look.
Yeah.
So it's super important before the comp to actually set up somewhere, like go out when you get your rack heights, look on the wall, know where you're gonna look, and on your opening attempt, practice it, because your opening's easy. And then let that carry through to the second and thirds.
So for me, like this isn't an issue if you get to handle somebody who's actually really, really good. But for my earlier competitors, like I almost always tell them on their first squat to try and use most of the minutes. So walk out onto the platform, look where they're going to look before they even approach the bar, go through the whole process, take extra long after the calls and just get comfortable in that space.
Yep.
And it's like a trial run. Definitely. Because by the third one, you're relying on just saying to them, like, find your spot.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them to be actually casting their eyes about looking for a comfortable position.
Yep.
You know?
I think the other thing people do is they don't train with their friends and family watching.
No.
So their friends and family, they can be distracting, or they shouldn't be, but they can be.
Absolutely.
And when you're, you know, trying to get yourself super in the zone and you see your mate you might get distracted. So you always got to keep the eyes on what you're doing, keep purpose about where you're looking, and they'll follow through to the squat.
Yeah. Probably one last thing that's just occurred to me on gaze, and it sort of ties into the upper back thing, is I like when I'm teaching people to unrack the bar, I actually like them to be looking up or looking at the point that they're going to look at during their squat. And I'm not sure if you agree, but something I've found is when people are looking down, often they look down and they round through their upper back.
Yeah, definitely.
And so like if you unrack with a rounded upper back, you're not going to re-extend it under 250 kilos.
Yeah, whatever. Correct.
It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, those are probably the errors in execution that I've noticed most in the squat.
I have one lifter who unracked the bar with his back, like you said, and I always have to cue him legs on the unrack, like use your legs on the unrack, which sounds really stupid, but like for him it works because he's hunched over and he's trying to back extend out of the rack. Really he just needs to bend his knees, get his weight under the bar, and actually use his legs to help him unrack the bar.
So if I was going to sum up maybe what we've said, is basically the errors that you see in execution in the squat tend to come from, other than the descent speed, they come from a poor setup and sort of people being rushed for whatever reason. So as a coach on the platform, your job is almost to walk your lifter through their own setup.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then once they're in the squat position, you can just rely on the cues you've done in training for execution of the descent.
So I like to use one cue for the unrack, one cue for the walkout, and then set eyes and weight for the calls, and then one cue on the way down and one cue on the way up.
Okay, perfect. Alrighty, so I guess that wraps up the squat. Let's talk about bench. We're back with bench. Alex has cake.
I do have cake.
And again, so we're talking about errors in execution that we see in heavy attempts in competitions. 1 second.
How's that sound?
That's Alex opening
a can of Monster is like, it's top 5 sounds.
Yeah, it's better than cracking open a cold frothy. That's what I've heard, is cracking open a cold Monster after a tough day.
I reckon they're close.
All right. So errors in execution in bench, the two biggest ones that I see are, again, descent speed. Just like with squat, I think when people feel that the weight is a little bit heavy in their hands, they're inclined to, again, either try and go too slow or too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And in bench, for me, in my experience, I've seen a lot of people going too fast, and then that carries over to position on the chest. So, a good bench, you should be reaching your chest up to the bar, you should be rock solid under it. I think when people's descent tempo goes all over the place, they tend to lose that tightness on the chest. And once you've done that, you have no chance of actually pressing a weight that should be maximal because you've taken yourself into a weaker position.
Definitely.
So it's two that carry over into each other for mine. And the other one that we were talking about pre your last mouthful, Alex, was people being comfortable operating with a pause. And probably the heavier it gets, the worse people are going to be, you know, at doing that. So what were you saying about pausing in training?
Well, the problem that we see in comp, first of all, is that we, a lot of people aren't prepared for the length of the pause in the
definitely.
Competition. So people need to practice with someone giving them calls, not their own calls. Because when you know when you're going to press, you load yourself up, and you're always ready to press and you get more out of it. If you have to hold tight on the chest and hold the bar still and then react to someone else's call, it's going to be probably 5 or 10 kilos difference between the two.
You reckon 5 or 10 kilos?
Mm.
I definitely think it's a different skill. And like, again, we were saying this earlier, for me, like I can anticipate my own press because I know when I've actually paused the bar as opposed to reacting to somebody else's.
But you're reacting to when the rule book says you're going to get the call, not when you're actually going to get the call.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's up to the referee's discretion on when they're going, when they believe the bar is stationary, not when you believe the bar is stationary.
Yeah.
So having someone, and I often during warm-ups I'll grab another coach and I'll say, you know, whatever, Will, can you give my lifter calls for this warm-up?
Yeah.
And so I think that helps a lot.
Because that's unfamiliarity with the length of calls.
Correct,
as well.
Yeah. Because if I coach them all the time in training, they know, like, they have a good idea when I'm going to say press. But if I get someone else, which is like what the referee is, that's what you want.
Yeah. So I guess let's actually talk about training then to get people better at these three things. So we'll start with pauses because we're on that, and then we can go back to descent speed and position. So getting people good at pausing for a long time and reacting to pauses, Do you think long pauses are a useful variation?
Definitely.
And then how are they best used?
I think they're best used with a three count or a two count. So yeah. Like 2 times or 3 times longer than the competition call. Not 3 seconds or 2 seconds, because that's a little bit longer. But I think the best execution is don't count for them. Don't let the bar touch his chest and say 1, 2, press. Actually, just don't say anything and make them react to the call, because they need to stay tight and they need to keep the bar stationary. So until the call.
It's exactly the same as practicing that skill of actually waiting for the call while being tight.
It's exactly the same as the competition lift, just longer.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So descent speed then in the bench press. Firstly, do you think there's a universal ideal, or do you think it's, or do you think it should be like some people should go slow, some people should go fast? What's the, is there like a maxim that you operate by?
There isn't. It's not as similar to the squat. It's more individual.
Yeah.
But for the general person, I would use the same 40 to 90.
Yeah.
On start at 40 and build a little bit of speed, but the emphasize the touch being soft. If it's too fast and it crashes down, you're not going to get the bar still enough to get a quick press.
Yeah. So even though this is probably the opposite issue to what I see in mates, I'm curious about your thoughts on this. An error that I see in training, particularly in inexperienced bench presses, is they start the descent fast and then they slow way down to the chest. And it's like they're wasting a whole lot of energy
trying to slow the bar. Yeah. This is what you used to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was doing it at a level of excellence that you don't normally see.
130 at 90. Nice.
Yeah. It was a very heavy 130 though. The moon was, it was far from Earth. What would make gravity less? Earth was heavy. It was a really good 130 in spite of that. So yeah, people whose descent starts fast and ends slow,
mm-hmm.
I tend to think that's a problem. Although I also do see a lot of extremely good bench presses with quite a slow descent as well.
I think the thing that's going to be true in all good bench presses is an increase in speed to the chest. So whether you start really slow or you start moderately slow or you start fast or whatever, there's always going to be an increase of speed to the chest.
Right. But then the touch itself has to be soft. So it's an increase in speed that doesn't lead to you then collapsing under the bar.
Correct. Yeah. So if, like you were saying before, if you start too quick, you're going to lose tension in the back, and then you're going to then have to fight to slow it down, and then you're going to be wasting energy, and then you're going to have nothing left for the press itself.
Okay. So descent speed, do you cue it particularly as a coach on the competition platform?
Not really, no. I cue soft touch.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. In training, is there anything that you think is especially valuable for teaching people a good position under the bar? So not necessarily the arch itself, but just holding that position on the chest.
You mean on the chest or on the unrack?
No, on the chest. So I was saying an error we see in execution is when people, like, after a shitty descent, they then tend to collapse under the bar.
Yeah.
So is there anything especially you do in training to address that, or is it just perfect bench reps?
Trying to pull the bar to the chest,
and
trying to pull the chest to the bar. So they're equally trying to meet each other.
Yeah. So it's a cueing emphasis. Is there anything especially you do in terms of exercises or programming, or is it pretty much just do it right?
One thing I like to do with just this is another technique thing. I like to put chalk on the bar.
Yeah.
And just make sure there's one mark on the shirt.
Yeah.
So if they do a set of 8 and they've got chalk from their nipples down to their belly button, they've done something wrong.
I've actually done that and ended up with chalk on my back.
And ladies and gentlemen, that is why Will is not good at bench press.
Yeah, it was crazy. I've had a few vertical lines as well. Things got weird. All right, I'll give you a second and have a bit of your cake, and then we'll do deadlifts. All right, so Alex eating his cake had one of his little fat man rants, which he does frequently. So a topic we've missed is the handoff, and I was sort of in defense of the lifter, saying that if you're getting a crappy handoff, it's at least partly the handoff guy's fault. But it can definitely impact how you do with your bench press itself. So Alex, what do you think the lifter's sort of responsibility is, and how can they go about getting the best handoff they can?
If you want a handout, you need to tell them what handout you want,
and
you need to be explicit with it.
Yeah, but can I just say that when you're explicit with it, like I did the handouts at the expo recently, and it was like you were getting, it was like taking coffee orders in Bondi. Like some of these people were saying, like, I want a, you know, medium extra soft handout, like, you know, with feeling, and like, you know, out to this area and like make it vegan. And like,
vegan handout.
Bear in mind, like, jokes aside, bear in mind that when you have a handout guy at the competition, most flights that you're competing in, or most groups sorry,
I didn't say flights.
Yeah, such an IBF elitist. Most groups you're competing in are going to have, you know, 10 or 15 people in them or whatever. So the guy doing the handout is going to have a decent number of people between you each time. So it is your responsibility each time you walk out. If you think you did a great job last time, it's still your responsibility to say, last one was great, you know, soft handout, bring it out to my chest for me, I'll say my bar when I'm happy. Remind them of the things that you want. Communicate clearly and take the time before each attempt. Don't just do it once because 100%. People don't remember your order
100%
straight away unless they train with you.
If you get a bad hand, if you want a handout and you fail to communicate with the handout person, and you get a bad handout and you miss your bench press and you blame the handout person, you're an idiot. It's your fault.
All right. So now we'll have a tiny bit more cake and come back for deadlifts.
Weekly weights.
All right, so back talking about deadlifts.
How was that Tim Tam?
My Tim Tam was actually pretty good. How was your Tim Tam?
Yeah, it was solid.
Yeah, as far as Tim Cams go, it was about normal.
Yeah, they're all the same.
Yeah, they're all the same. You know, when I was overseas, literally every single person I spoke to who had been to Australia raved about Tim Tams.
And hated Vegemite.
Yeah, they all hate Vegemite.
Cowards.
But they love Tim Tams. Like, yeah, they're sending them home to their family and stuff. Like, they just rave about them.
Shout out to all the Australians who hate Vegemite. You cowards.
Yeah, unpopular opinion, I reckon Promite's better than Vegemite. When I go overseas, I would eat Vegemite proudly and grin, but at home, I'd buy Promite.
You're a coward.
Well, I'm a dietitian, so my opinion on Promite's probably correct. Let's talk about deadlifts.
Do you like deadlifts?
Yeah, they're better than bench. This podcast is going rapidly downhill. All right. So errors in execution. By the time people have gotten to the deadlift, obviously, many lifters, particularly beginner lifters who mightn't have sort of a stronger psychological grasp on what competing is, have sort of started to form opinions of their day. I definitely think like their psyche can kind of leak into their execution, particularly with heavy attempts that sort of become a bit make or break. So I think when you have lifters who are low on confidence or have missed other lifts, that can lead into it. Like, that can definitely bleed into the way they go about deadlifting.
100%. Definitely.
And so you come to a third deadlift, it's the end of your meet, it's the culmination of your day. And I think a lot of people, you know, are seeing a lot riding on it, even if they're just sort of your average competitor. And the first thing that I often see is a rushed setup.
Definitely.
So lifters have run out, they've been belted over the head by their coach because their coach is Alex. And Alex loves to hit his clients. Lifters run out, grab the bar, and there's a few issues with a rushed setup in the deadlift. The first one is just inconsistency. So when you deadlift, the bar should start in the same place every time. Your body should start in the same place around it. The second you're rushing your setup, the chances of that happening are reduced.
Mm-hmm.
So that's number one. Number two, lots of lifters do that sort of like raise your hips and then drop your hips thing to get a bit of a stretch reflex and help themselves off the floor.
So if you were to rush that, your shoulders would end up in front of the bar.
End up in front of the bar, knees end up too far in front of the bar. Sometimes you bash it with your shins. So basically you're throwing the bar out of position in the circumstances where you have the least capacity to actually overcome a poor position.
Mm-hmm.
So that's number one. And number two, your opportunity to get tight is reduced. This is maybe a separate rant, but it's one that I feel really strongly about. I think a lot, too many people, particularly conventional pullers, try to be aggressive off the floor and they do it at the expense of holding position.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with heavy weights, not easing the bar off the floor per se, but emphasizing tightness before speed.
Holding shape.
Yeah, you hold your shape and then you can accelerate through the movement.
Yep.
Do a lot more for you. So I think it's something kind of difficult to teach without just getting people to do a lot of deadlifts and do a lot of heavy ones. But getting people to actually get good at being tight, holding their shape, and then getting off the floor will help. So
that's one thing that I used to struggle with. I used to sacrifice my lockout for speed off the floor. And then I really scaled it back, and now I'm sort of a lot more patient and I'm just a lot smoother through the pull.
Yeah. And so anyway, sorry to bring that back to like the error in execution is a rush setup. Those are the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the factor that bleeds into a rush setup is hyperaggression. So even though, like, as coaches, I think we're trying to engineer the most psyched up athlete we can for the last deadlift, because it's the lift needing the most arousal and it's the least technically demanding.
Yep.
As a coach, we also want to sort of channel that aggression in useful ways.
Yep.
So but I think
there's different lifters that respond to different arousals as well. So we have to know our lifter.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah.
You're not just gonna beat anyone to a pulp and expect them to come out the other side and kill it. It doesn't work.
But if you got like a team PB 285 attempt, then you can afford to sort of engineer a lot more aggression.
Four guys
holding you up against the wall, pouring beer on you and yelling at you. shout out to Tim Davies. So you can do that. That's valuable. But even I think if you have tried to generate that atmosphere of aggression, it's still your job as a coach to then walk your athlete through their setup. You just do it with maybe 20 to 30% more sort of excitement than you normally would. So when people are deadlifting, they should have two or three cues. For me, often it's got something to do with sort of like, you know, how they set their stance or where they distribute their weight, something to do with getting a big breath and setting their back tight, and then something to do with the pull itself.
Mm-hmm.
So three things, you can do them sequentially. You do them, you GM up, you don't have to throw in anything else into the mix. But if you engineered enough excitement out the back and the circumstances itself in the meet have gotten the athlete excited, then they can just get out there and execute their job. I don't think necessarily sending them in a mindless rage is ever the best circumstance unless they're just unbelievably good and going to do it autonomously.
Yeah. I actually think that can go the other way, though. I have a lot of lifters who will overthink.
Yeah.
And it's better for them to just walk out, set your feet, grab the bar and go. And that will work with some lifters and not work with others, obviously.
Yeah, and I can agree with that as well. I've definitely... I've been with you at meets and you hate watching this. There are some lifters who miss their third deadlift and it looks like they've almost not tried. Like, they just have no heart.
Can't deal with that.
Yeah, and often I think the root cause of that is overthinking. Like, these people have gotten really psyched up, or they think that there's something about the situation that is especially stressful or concerning or different. And they think way too hard about what they have to do to get this bar moving, because they've built like this third deadlift up on a pedestal as being this incredibly difficult physical task. And yeah, they get so focused on execution, they don't put in the effort. So that can definitely be an issue as well.
A lot of people give up too quickly.
Yeah.
And a lot of people will rush and fall away from their shape. Like, let's say someone is patient off the floor and it's slow, and it gets to the knee.
Yeah.
And they're not patient enough to hold their shape and push their hips forward, and they maybe lean back and bend their knees and try and wrap it onto their quads, and then they'll miss on a technicality. But that wasn't a strength issue. That was just they weren't patient enough to stay with it.
Yeah.
So some people are too patient. Some people aren't patient enough. And I think that comes back to knowing your lifter. Know what their tendencies are, know what their response is psychologically, and then trying to create the best mixture of psych up, keeping them composed, and keeping them purposeful to attack and execute the lift.
So that was basically what I was going to say. So your role as a coach is basically know your athlete, engineer the exact right level of psych in, and then put them out there.
Yeah, put the pieces of the puzzle together and hope that it's enough.
Yeah.
And if not, then go back to the drawing board and figure out where you went wrong.
All right. And probably the second biggest error I see in deadlift execution at meets is pulling sumo.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So, God, I hate sumo.
Cowards.
It's, you know what's weird though, is despite being cheating, it's considerably harder for me. But that's, same. I think, because of my strong moral character.
And your weak legs.
Yeah, my weak legs. All right. So, okay, how do we, in training, is there anything especially you think you can do just to help people with getting their deadlift set up sort of correct and consistent? Is there anything you do?
Consistent setup and position every time you do a set. So there are coaches who might use like clustered singles. So more chances to approach the bar, more first reps, which that has a lot of validity.
Yeah.
I don't use a lot of that myself, but I have in the past.
Yeah.
other than that, technically, like with holding shape and being patient, as we spoke about before, pause deadlifts can be good. Mm-hmm. So holding your shape, get that spine angle that you want,
yeah,
maintain it, pause at the shin, and then start to accelerate from there. And it sort of teaches the lifter to be patient and then only think about speed when finishing the pull, not when starting the pull. And I think that's one thing that I teach my beginners is don't even think about speed on a deadlift. Get yourself tight, hold your shape, and then push your hips forward to the bar with speed. And one cue that I used is no noise. And when you yank the bar off the floor, it will make a noise.
Yeah, so you gotta have the tightness, like the slack out of the bar. Yeah,
so you gotta have the slack out of the bar and the tension in the bar, and as you bring the bar off the floor, there should be no noise from the barbell.
Yeah. So I have two thoughts immediately, and I'll probably have more as I talk. I do like clustered singles, or even not clustered singles, you know, my own deadlift at the moment I'm doing. Yeah, EMOMs. At least half the reason I do that is to have more first reps.
Uh-huh.
And I also think that keeping lots of reps, like a decent way from failure in your deadlift training, is a good way to make sure you can do things technically consistently.
Uh-huh. Especially early in the block.
Yeah, and so if you can do that, and you can accumulate large amounts of volume quickly and efficiently, that's good.
Definitely.
So I like EMOMs at least partly for that. I'm a real stickler for getting people's start position correct in deadlifts. So I basically just emphasize consistency over and over and over again, and I would rather see them train their deadlift lighter before I let them progress it, or just programming only one set that I consider even remotely hard, and then a lot of sets that they should just be able to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
So basically I just go for consistency, consistency, consistency. Number two, and this is probably a carryover from, I had a brief stint in weightlifting, is I actually kind of like using deadlift variations, not pause deadlift necessarily, but things like deficits and block pulls and training the deadlift in sort of a part hole fashion. So one of the reasons I like block pulls, I've been trying them myself and I'm trying them on a couple of athletes. Initially, I thought they'd be good for strengthening the hips because I thought that if I just got rid of that first bit of knee extension, it would help me like really practice loading the hamstrings and the hips. But something that I realized as well is you're getting people to start the pull from a replicable position over and over. So it's you've taken that leg drive out of like that first bit of leg drive out and you're getting people to reinforce a position you want them to get to. So if you set the blocks roughly where you want people to pause when they're doing a pause deadlift,
yep,
and you get them to do that over and over again,
yep,
then you're strengthening that position. And I think the stronger you are in that position, the more likely you are to want to assume it under load.
Yeah, I use block pulls and pause deadlifts interchangeably. Yep. So like I'll default to pauses.
Yep.
If the lifter does them badly, shout out Brandon. Shout out...
Ron Flett, always.
Alex Moyer. who else?
Let's not call out all our clients.
Rufus. Yep. Those who get block pulls, probably because they're bad at pauses. Yep.
So my second thing about block pulls, and maybe you'll give more lifters block pulls after this. So one, you know they're always getting to the same position to start, which I guess you know they're going to pause in the same spot. But they start in the same position. And number two, I actually like doing them touch and go or with like a controlled eccentric because I think the eccentric itself can help you with motor learning.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to feel out a position a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the block there. You basically know they're going to get to somewhere. They're going to have a vertical shin, which is roughly what you want at that point in mm-hmm. the pull. You can strengthen it from there and you can get them to feel their way down into that position with eccentrics.
Yep.
So all of that makes me think that they're a useful tool.
Yep.
And then I do deficit deadlifts and I've been doing them touch and go myself and for most of my clients recently as well, again with a controlled eccentric, because after that first little bit of leg drive, you sort of lose the advantage of the touch and go part of a deficit deadlift right at that point in the shin as well, right? So you strengthen that position.
Mm-hmm.
So you lose the benefit of that little bounce, touch and go bit, the deficit, your mid shin, which is roughly where people are starting to lose their position. You either strengthen the back or you get people to actually get good at being in that position and holding it. And again, I emphasize people actually having their back position correct when they do it.
Yeah, definitely.
So for me, it's basically replicable start position on all of your normal deadlifts. Keep your sets a fair way from failure
mm-hmm.
and then use your variations to strengthen the positions that people are kind of shitty at assuming at heavy pulls.
Yep.
And just do that over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you on keeping the deadlift the lowest percentage of the three as far as training load.
Yeah.
Like probably. Keeping them the furthest from failure. But I tend to program only pulls from the floor or off blocks. I don't usually go with deficits.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening, guys. We'll wrap it up there. If you want to follow us on social media, I'm AlexHayes_lift.
And I'm W.BerkmanPT.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you can get this every week. And we'll chat to you next week.
Thank you.